Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. Sri Chaitanya Manobhishtam. Stapitang Yena Bhutale. Swayam Rupa Kadamayam. Dadati Swapadantikam. Trinadapi Sunichena. Tarodiva Sahishnuna. Amanina Manadena. Kirtaniya Sadahari. Hare Nama, Hare Nama, Hare Nama Vikevalam, Kalo Nastyeva, Nastyeva, Nastyeva Gatir Anyata. The third chapter of Bhagavad Gita is entitled Karma Yoga. Karma means different things. It can mean work, action, activity. Those are the general definitions of the word karma. The word yoga means a scientific process by which one links with the Supreme. There are different types of transcendentalists. For some, the Supreme is the impersonal, all-pervasive Brahman. Such transcendentalists are known as impersonalists. Another kind of transcendentalist understands Paramatma, the Supersoul, God dwelling in the heart. For them, that is the Supreme, and they are known as yogis. And then the third class of transcendentalists, they understand the Supreme as Bhagavan, the personality or the person of God, either as Krishna or one of his personal or Svangsha expansions, which we call Narayan or Vishnu. So depending on the kind of transcendentalist, their understanding of the Supreme is different. This chapter, third chapter of Bhagavad Gita, linking with the Supreme by means of work, action, activity. It's not that any work is karma yoga. No. The action, the work, has to actually be a scientific process by which you link with the Supreme. So a karmi yogi, a karma yogi, is different from a karmi. One may be a fruitive worker, but he's not linking with the Supreme. In order for one to be a karma yogi, the actions must be approved, authorized, and actually enable you to link with God. In this third chapter of Bhagavad Gita, there are different sections. In the first three verses, after hearing from Krishna in chapter 2, Arjuna heard, because he asked a question in chapter 2, what are the symptoms of someone who has merged in transcendence? Arjuna also heard in chapter 2, Buddhi Yoga, linking with God by means of intelligence. But at the same time, in chapter 2, Krishna is telling Arjuna that he wants him to fight and kill. So, in the beginning of chapter 3, Arjuna is still confused. Arjuna was confused in chapter 1, and in the beginning of chapter 2, Arjuna was so confused that he said to Krishna, I'm so confused. I don't know what I should do. Therefore, I want you to be my guru. And I want you to tell me what I'm supposed to do at this time when I'm in a crisis. Therefore, Arjuna said the famous words, Shishyastehaṁ śādhimāṁ tvaṁ prapanam. That's the turning point of Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna stops being Arjuna's equal friend and becomes his superior by acting as his shiksha or instructing spiritual master, shiksha guru. But in the beginning of chapter 3, Arjuna is confused because Krishna has been explaining using the intelligence, merging with the transcendence, and he also wants him to fight. Arjuna doesn't know what's going on. So now, in chapter 3, Krishna explains, the first thing Krishna explains is the concept of false renunciation. False renunciation means that someone is pretending to be transcendental, pretending to be detached from the material world, but actually the mind is still very much interested in the senses and sense objects. That's called mithyachara, pretender. Real renunciation, as explained by Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita and further explained in books like Srimad Bhagavatam and others, renunciation is like two sides of a coin. One side of renunciation is detachment from material sense enjoyment. One side of this detachment or renunciation is to become disinterested in enjoying the material world with the senses. And the other side of the coin of renunciation or detachment is attachment to Krishna, attachment to God. Just being detached from the material world will not give you perfection. There must be a positive side. It can't be simply negative. There must be something positive. In chapter 2, Krishna explained a line, Parang Jistva Nivartite. He said, there is a thing called superior taste. Not that you give up taste altogether. There is inferior taste and there is superior taste. Superior taste means transcendental pleasure, such as signified by the word Rama. Everyone say. Lord Shiva explained to his wife Parvati, Durga, that he is chanting this name of Rama, everyone, because he derives great transcendental pleasure by chanting those two syllables over and over and over and over again. Lord Shiva is the greatest example of renunciation. Even though Lord Shiva is the consort of the material energy, and he could have the most opulent residence, he prefers to live the life of renunciation. He lives under a tree. His dress is very simple. And his bodily features are very unique and distinct. But Lord Shiva is not simply detached from the material world. Simultaneously, he is very attached to the Supreme Lord. That is why you will see at the end of Srimad Bhagavatam, Vaishnavanam Yatha Shambhu. The greatest worshipper, the greatest devotee of Lord Vishnu is Lord Shiva. And he is always chanting that name, Ram, Ram, Ram. Everyone, three times. So he is a perfect example of this two-sided coin. He is completely detached from material sense gratification, even though he is married to the personification of the material energy. And at the same time, he is very much attached to Lord Narayan, Lord Vishnu. There is another concept on this topic of false renunciation. Yukta Vairagya. Yukta Vairagya means feasible or practical renunciation. It's not that we are simply meant to perform severe penances and austerities. Severe penances and austerities are there, but especially in this day and age, the best program is called feasible yukta vairagya. For instance, it's explained in Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna says, you can offer me a leaf, a flower, fruit of water, I will accept. And also in the Bhakti Marg and in this temple, we cook food, and then before eating, it is offered to the Lord as sacrifice. So it's not that eating is denied. In personalist school, they teach you, you have to eat so miserly, so niggardly, can hardly, you're not hardly allowed to eat anything in the impersonal path. Tonight, you will eat what? Full set of sumptuous prasad. So, this offering of bhog and then taking the remnants, this is yukta vairag, feasible. So that's why in the next section of chapter 3, the topic is the cycle of sacrifice. And Krishna points out in this section of chapter 3 that everybody is working. Everybody is performing activities. But some people, by their work, by their activities, they are simply becoming entangled. They're becoming entangled in this life and in the future life. Entangled means, in the future life, meaning you have to take birth again in this material world. Taking birth in this material world is considered a term of imprisonment. The goal is liberation. But if I'm working in this material world only to get another term of imprisonment, then that means I'm becoming entangled. Or even in this sphere, if I'm working, but by my working, I get involved in being arrested, if I commit some crime. I did work, but now I become entangled. Businessmen, they want to make more and more and more money. But if they act in the wrong way, then they can become entangled and lose everything. Can be taxes or a bad investment. So depending on how I'm working, some of us are getting entangled and some of us are becoming liberated or elevated, promoted. So Krishna says in chapter 3, unless your actions are satisfactory to God, unless your actions are approved. In other words, he uses the word yajna, sacrifice. One of Lord Vishnu's names is yajna. He is the person who is the benefactor of any sacrifice. Even if somebody is like you do the Satyanarayan Katha, you have the deity of Lord Vishnu represented. Because it is actually Vishnu who is the enjoyer of any sacrifice. So Krishna points out, unless your actions are pleasing to the Supreme Lord Vishnu or Krishna, then you may be working very hard, but you're working very hard to become entangled. Say you're going to school. So, the idea is to study properly and promote yourself to the next grade, the next grade, next grade. Get your diploma. So, we are all working in this world. The idea is to reach the stage of liberation. That is your diploma as a human being. Your diploma as a human being is that you get liberation. You don't come back to this material world. So Krishna points out that whatever you're doing should be done as a sacrifice. It should be pleasing to the Supreme Lord. Then Krishna points out in this chapter about eating. He says very clearly that eating, there are two kinds of eating. There is eating which is purifying, and then there is eating which is sinful. So what is that sinful eating? Food which is not offered as sacrifice. It may even be vegetarian. But unless that food is offered as sacrifice, the line is very clear. One is simply eating lumps of sin. So one may be a vegetarian sinner. Yes? So Krishna says, the devotees are released from sin because they eat food which is first offered as sacrifice, like we do in this temple. So even in our homes, we should also be conscious of what Krishna is saying, that the food has to be first offered as sacrifice. Otherwise, one is only eating sin. And if one eats sin, then there is going to be reaction in the body. It is going to affect the bodily health, And it's also going to affect one's mentality. If one is eating food offered to God, then one's mind becomes very nice. I am asked so many times by people, Swamiji, Prabhuji, how can I have peace? So here's your first prescription. Don't eat anything unless you first offer it to God as sacrifice. Otherwise, that food is going to cause a disturbance in the body and mind. Then the next question automatically comes, what food is fit for being offered in sacrifice? That's the next question. If one accepts this principle as stated in Bhagavad Gita, that food has to be first offered as sacrifice, then the next question is, what kind of food should be offered? And that is explained later in Bhagavad Gita in chapter 17. That there is food in the mode of goodness, food in the mode of passion, and food in the mode of ignorance. It's not the same. And as far as offering food to God, you cannot offer Him food in the mode of passion and ignorance. He will not accept. The proper foods to offer Lord Vishnu or Krishna as a sacrifice are foods in the category of the mode of goodness. Vegetables, except onions, garlic, mushrooms, which are in the modes of passion and ignorance. But vegetables, fruits, grains, legumes, fruit, nuts, liquids, obviously not alcohol, as that is in the mode of passion and ignorance. If you study every year here, every year you do the Govardhan festival, right? So, during that Govardhan festival, if you read the Leela, you will see that when Krishna is instructing His father in the residence of Vrindavan, we're not going to worship Indra. Instead, we're going to do a sacrifice to please the cows, Brahmins, and Govardhan Hill. And Krishna then says, and there should be a big feast. And Krishna is very specific what should be offered. Rasgulla, laddus, puris, kachoris, samosa, rice, halava, sabji, no taco, no beer. He's very clear. The list is there of what he said should be offered. In the next section of chapter 3, Krishna explains that when one becomes a self-realized soul, then there are no more prescribed duties for such a person. Because the whole purpose of performing prescribed duties is to come to the point of full self-realization. Yet, someone who is in the self-realized category still acts to show the example for everyone else. That is very significant. That although one may be on the self-realized platform, still to set the example for everyone else, such a person behaves according to the rules and regulations of the scriptures. In the next part of chapter 3, Krishna also points out himself. Krishna says, I'm God. I'm the Supreme. I don't have to follow any rules and regulations. I am above the law. And I don't need to do anything. But Krishna says, yet, when I come, you see that I behave. The best example is the pastimes of Krishna in Dwaraka, when Krishna lived as a householder, and he only married 16,108 wives. So, I know, after all, he's Ananta, unlimited. So when Krishna was living in his 16,108 palaces, he lived just like an ideal householder, following all the Vedic rules and regulations. He didn't need to, but to sow by example. Once Narada came and visited Krishna, and Narada went to each and every palace. And so when he went to one palace, there was Krishna lying on his bed. And Krishna spoke to Narada. Then he quickly went to the next palace. Krishna was taking a bath. He went to the next palace. Krishna was eating. He went to the next. In every palace that Narada visited, Krishna was doing something else. For Narada, this was astounding. Because Narada himself has the ability to do yogic expansions. But those yogic expansions can only do the same thing. Like, you go to the shop to pick out a new TV. So sometimes they have 50 TVs, but they're all showing the same channel. So a yogi is like that. He can do up to 8-9 expansions, but they're all doing the same thing. Whereas Krishna's expansions, no. Each one was doing something completely different. In one palace, Krishna was arranging the marriages of his sons and daughters. In another palace, it is described Krishna was riding on a horse. And it's explained by Shukadeva Goswami, how was Krishna ideally behaving in the palace? You all know, what time of the day does the rooster make its sound? Yes, early. Yes, before sunrise. That was Krishna's alarm clock. As soon as the rooster would crow, Krishna would get up from bed, much to the dismay of Rukmini and all the other queens. Because it's described by Shukadev that Krishna was lying in bed, 16,108 beds, being embraced by 16,108 goddesses of fortune. And yet, when the rooster crowed, Krishna immediately got up, washed his hands and feet, and began his spiritual practices, teaching us, you might be lying in bed. All of you husbands, you have your goddess of fortune. So you may be lying in bed, but early morning means rise and begin your spiritual practices, sadhana. Huh? What are you saying? That's right, we have mechanical rooster. Everyone has mechanical rooster. Just have to set it. And we should begin our daily spiritual practices. Krishna himself did that just to show us Morning time is for spiritual life. Because as the day progresses, different modes of nature become prominent. From 1.5 hours before sunrise, up until about 8-9 o'clock in the morning, mode of goodness is prevalent. So you will find spiritual principles and practice to be most easy in the morning, most conducive. Then, as we go from morning to midday, Shri Radha Raman Bhagavan Ki, as we go from morning to midday, mode of passion begins to develop. Those of you who have to go on the freeway to go to work, you know what it's like. Maybe you're leaving your house in the morning, but once you get on the freeway, now you know. Okay, mode of passion. Then depending if you work downtown or in the big city, now, and once you get to the office, you know, passion. Then, as the day wanes and we get towards sunset, the mode of ignorance starts to become very prominent. Trying to do spiritual activities in the evening, hard work. But if you do in the morning, early, you can zip through it. You can do it in the evening, but it's hard. So Krishna says, although I don't have to, although I am above all rules and regulations, and I don't need to get anything, still, to set the example, I work, I appear. When Krishna was in Vrindavan, Krishna had chores. When Krishna was in Dwaraka, he had his activities he had to do. Now in the next part of chapter 3, the Krishna says that some people, they work and they identify themselves as the only doer of the action. They don't consider anything else. Somebody who's learned knows, yes, I may be acting, but I'm not the only actor. There's still the hand of God, and that still is giving me, like it says in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, I am the ability in man. So a foolish person is someone who takes credit for everything. But a wise person is someone who knows, yes, I was able to do this activity, but I was being helped or assisted by my dear most friend, Krishna in the heart. That is why a learned person, what is the symbol of a learned person? Humility. The symbol of somebody who actually has knowledge is that they have this quality of humility. I believe it was Einstein. He said that what he understood was only a little bit. Like you think he said something about the sand on the beach. He understood there was so much he didn't know. So a learned person recognizes that even someone does something very wonderful, the learned person knows, yes, by the grace of God, I was able to achieve this thing. That is the mark of a learned person. Whereas the ignorant person takes all credit. Yeah, I did that. Just see what I did. Not knowing that at any moment, while the person is claiming, I did this, if Krishna wants, he can make that person deaf, mute, blind, lame. Yes. And then Krishna says, we should not disturb the ignorant who think like that. But we should teach by example and try to show them how it is much better to work in the spirit of devotion. The spirit of devotion means that everything I do, everything I say is an offering to God. The spirit of devotion. The final section of Bhagavad Gita chapter 3 is the topic of lust. In this final section, Arjuna asks a question. Arjuna says to Krishna, why is it that sometimes people do things which are sinful and it seems like they're being forced to do this? So Krishna answers Arjuna's question by saying, yes, it is lust. And lust is the all-devouring sinful enemy of this world. Lust means I want to enjoy this material world to its fullest extent, and I don't care about anything else. Ravan is considered the incarnation of lust. So if you want to know what is lust, study the life and teachings of Ravan, because he's described as lust incarnate. Lust means I want to be the enjoyer. I want to be the controller. I want to be the center of attention. I want everyone to love me because I'm so wonderful. Let me enjoy myself. So Krishna says, this is the all-devouring sinful enemy of this world. And then he says, Krishna says, there's a problem with lust. It is never satisfied. That's the problem with lust. No matter how you go for it, no matter how you try to satisfy your lusty desires, it will never end. And we learned in chapter 2, this topic came up briefly in chapter 2, since lust is never to be satisfied, as a result, one becomes angry and frustrated. And so in chapter 3, Krishna says, Dushpurain Analenacha. It's never to be satisfied, and it burns like fire. It's a burning within the heart. And that is the problem with lust. And lust, Krishna points out, where is it hiding? Krishna says, lust is hiding in the mind, in the intelligence, and the senses. And we learned in chapter 2, how does the whole cycle begin? Contemplating the objects of the senses. You contemplate, you become attached, then you want to enjoy. That's where the whole spiral starts. The advertising agencies know this very well. They know that I will make this advertisement on TV so attractive that as soon as they see it, you become attached. Then their propaganda preaching comes in. And then you say, yes, I want that toothpaste. I want that food. I want whatever they're selling. That's the whole cycle. But Krishna says, lust is never to be satisfied and it burns like fire. So what to do? So Krishna says, what to do? Here is your solution. First of all, you should understand the hierarchy. The hierarchy is such. Your senses are actually superior to the sense objects. So understand that. Your senses are actually superior to the sense objects unless you give in. But if you don't give in, the senses are superior. Now, superior to the senses is the mind. So if your mind is strong, then you're not going to give in to the senses. Just like I made a New Year's resolution a few days ago. So it's simply a matter of me being fixed in my mind. No, I made this resolution. Doesn't matter what's going to happen, I'm going to execute my resolution. Or like on a fasting day. It's not that on a fasting day you don't get hungry. It's not on a fasting day you don't still have the same urges. But what? You've made up your mind. This is fasting day. Even though my tongue and senses are demanding, come on. Have that food. No. You made up your mind in the beginning of the day. Today, I'm fasting. So the mind is superior to the senses. It's just a question of becoming determined and fixed. Then you can do it. Then Krishna says, higher than the mind, intelligence. What is intelligence? The discriminating factor of the mind. The mind accepts, rejects, likes, dislikes. Intelligence determines, we'll do this, we won't do this. Even though the mind is accepting and rejecting, like in the case of a fast day, the mind may be saying, well, I don't want to do this fast, but intelligence says, no, no, no. Best thing is to do the fast. So it's the higher faculty of the mind to discriminate what is to be done and what's not to be done. And then Krishna says, and above the intelligence, soul. Because the senses, the sense objects, the mind, and the intelligence are all material. The soul is spiritual. And later in Bhagavad Gita, we will find out there's something superior to soul. Super soul. Krishna dwelling in the heart. That we will learn later. There's not anything about super soul so far. That comes later in Bhagavad Gita. So here's the hierarchy. So therefore, Krishna ends the chapter. Thus, knowing oneself to be transcendental, because, after all, what was the first lesson of Bhagavad Gita in chapter 2? You're not your body, you're not your mind, you're not your senses. Your soul. That was lesson number 1. So here Krishna is saying, thus knowing that you are transcendental to the material senses, mind, and intelligence, O mighty armed Arjuna, or we could say, O mighty armed residents of Radharaman temple, one should steady the mind by deliberate spiritual intelligence. Deliberate spiritual intelligence. Where do you get that? You get that We're going to do japa, right? That's big way to get spiritual intelligence. Or read the Bhagavad Gita. You will get spiritual intelligence. Or take shelter of a spiritual trainer. A spiritual trainer can give you intelligence, deliberate spiritual intelligence. And thus, by spiritual strength, conquer this insatiable enemy known as lust. In other words, we said, and Krishna said, lust is public enemy number one. Prahlad said that to his father. Prahlad said, no, my father, you're in this whole realm of, because he thought, Hiranyakashipu thought that Lord Vishnu was his enemy. But Prahlad said, no, your only enemy is your own uncontrolled mind and senses. That's your enemy. No other enemy. So here Krishna is saying, by spiritual strength, conquer this insatiable enemy known as lust. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama. So now we will do the japa class and conquer this insatiable enemy known as lust. All right? He is given that service by Krishna. Each of the modes of nature are taken charge of. Lord Brahma is given in charge of the mode of passion. Lord Shiva is given charge of the mode of ignorance. But he's not in ignorance. He is, and he even tells Sati, I am always in Krishna consciousness. In Canto 4 of Bhagavatam, he tells his wife Sati, I am always in Vasudev consciousness, Krishna consciousness. So just because he's given charge of something, he's not affected. Just like in a prison, you have wardens. They're in the prison, but they're not prisoners. They're in charge of the prison. So, when the time comes, when Lord Shiva gets a text message from Lord Sankarshan, time to destroy, then he does his dance, right? And the universe becomes destroyed. That's his service. So he may be in charge, but he's in charge. He's not one of the prisoners. Good enough? Okay, I will answer this question privately with you because we're out of time. Fair enough? Because they're already giving me the signal. No, I'll speak to him afterwards.